From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. The anthrax scare, the war in far-off Afghanistan, the trouble boiling over in Pakistan and Israel. Terrible things are happening, and we still haven't grasped the full emotional impact of the September 11th attacks.
We need to have some respect for the power of evil that was present here and what it does not only to family members of those killed and wounded, not only to those who are working at the site, but the incredible ripple impact of this throughout thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people.
This hour, what we might learn from the other major terrorist attack in America, the bombing in Oklahoma City, and how people there tried to make sense of the senseless. Also, heroes and cowards. A cultural historian dissects the real meaning of courage. But first, why one expert on militant Islam is very nervous.
I fear that a lot of what we're doing is in the guise of either retaliating or punishing the people who did this specific act. But I fear that what we're facing right now could very quickly evolve into a world war, and it can involve substantial American deaths on home turf.
Anthropologist Cynthia Mahmood is one of a handful of Western scholars who've actually sat down and talked with Islamic terrorists. She says reading the Quran won't give you much insight into Osama bin Laden's admirers because their anger is rooted in politics, not religion. As Mahmood told Steve Paulson, to understand this culture, you have to see it on its home ground.
You need to be on what's been called the Arab street. You need to talk to regular people, and you need to go to local mosques where the mullahs or the imams are preaching a version of Islam that may not be the Quranic version. It may not be what experts and scholars find to be a valid interpretation of Islam. But it's the culture of the street that has spawned Osama bin Laden and others of his ilk, and that's what we need to study.
I want to talk some about your work as an anthropologist in some of these countries. You've talked with militant Muslims who've committed what we would call terrorist acts, and I'm wondering if you can tell me what they're like.
Yes, I have done that. That's my specialization as an anthropologist. I study religion and violence. I visited guerrilla camps in the mountains of Pakistan, which fighters were training for the jihad both in Afghanistan and in Kashmir, which is being fought over between India and Pakistan. When I visited their guerrilla camps, I usually would try to go and perform some sort of service to build trust, first of all. For example, the very first time I went, I volunteered in a field hospital where wounded fighters were being treated for quite a while and became eventually accepted in the role of caregiver to them. And I started hearing some of their stories, and only gradually I would broach the topic of, would it be all right if we write this down, and would it be all right if I publish it and if I analyze it and write about you? A couple of the stories that I heard from people, often very young boys, by the way, include things like one of them had set off a bomb in an urban neighborhood, not a military target, had set off a bomb in an urban neighborhood and had set off three other bombs in different locations so that if people ran away from the first bomb, they would be caught by the second. And if they ran away from the second, they would be caught by the third, and so on.
This sounds horrifying.
It's horrifying, and even more horrifying to me was the fact that this militant had used children on bicycles to bring the bombs into the neighborhood, hidden in grocery packets, without telling the children exactly what they were doing. It put them at great risk and, of course, made them ethically complicit in this, you know, horrible act.
What did you say to this person? Did you tell him that you found this abhorrent?
Yes. I mean, of course, it is a very intense personal experience to be sitting, literally having tea with a person who is telling very calmly about this abomination. But I'm always very honest with them because I don't want to later have them feel that I betrayed them by writing my opinions about them in the press or something. And in this case, as he's telling me this story, I just said, you know, I've got to tell you how horrified I am to be sitting here hearing this. And what possible reason can you give why it was justified to kill civilians? And, you know, in fact, the reason that particular individual gave was that his religious community had suffered torture, had suffered oppression. They had been publicly taunted by people in that neighborhood. And he felt, you know, that that gave him somehow the certainly the anger, if not the justification, as a way of communicating back very publicly, nope, you can't keep us down.
Have you talked to anyone else who's done anything like this?
Well, if I may just add one thing, in that same case, there were other fighters sitting around listening as he was telling this, and I also turned to the others, and I said, do you guys condemn this? Do you think this is a legitimate thing to set off a bomb in a neighborhood, no matter how much that individual had suffered torture or his community had suffered? And they all immediately said, no, that's unjustifiable. You can hit a military target or even a police target, an agent of the state, but setting off a bomb in a neighborhood is never allowable. And then I said to them, well, why don't you guys publicly condemn what he did then? I mean, why don't you stand up and say, we're throwing you out of our group because this is not allowable? And in fact, they very sadly said to me, well, we can't do that because he's our brother and he's a hero and he's very brave and he was trying his best and mistakes get made.
Any other kinds of stories like this?
I have heard so many. Let me tell a slightly different angle on one. This was from a young kid, maybe 13 or 14, no beard or anything. He, in fact, was in this hospital way up in the mountains between India and Pakistan. And he told the story of how when he was growing up in Kashmir, at one point security forces came to his home. They burned down the house and they killed the people and they tied his sister up to a post in the basement and they repeatedly raped her and shouted all kinds of insults and so on. And the boy's grandfather was forced to watch this entire episode. And the grandfather was so humiliated by having had to witness his inability to protect the granddaughter that he took out an axe and killed the granddaughter to save the family honor. You know, how can we hear this stuff? But this is what happened. And the grandfather, an old, old guy, partially crippled, started climbing up these mountains with the young boy to join the Mujahideen to fight back for their dignity. Well, of course, he couldn't even make it up the mountains at all. They had to turn him back, and about 30, 34 other young kids had joined them, and they said, don't worry, grandfather, you go back home with relatives, and we will do the fighting for you, and we will die to redeem your family's honor. They struggled up this path. A couple of them got shot on the way by security forces. Others of them died from being frozen to death on these high mountain passes. Others of them fell off cliffs. When they got finally across to the guerrilla training camp, there was only four of them left, and this young man was one of them. He had severe frostbite. He's laying there in the hospital bed, and he was obviously filled with fierce determination now that all these sacrifices had been made, and it's now up to him and three other 13-year-olds to go back and fight and redeem the honor of the whole place. And then while he's laying there telling this, and obviously he's going to be capable of the most horrific deeds, I think. Then he kind of reached toward my hand and he said, Auntie, he called me Auntie, he said, Auntie, can you please get a message to my grandfather back in India? Because he said, I know that you BBC, I'm not with the BBC, but that's what they've heard of. And he said, I know you BBC people have connections and please tell my grandpa that I'm still alive and I'm all right.
So it's not as if these are cold-blooded people. They're filled with rage for one reason or another.
That's right. Here's a little kid, basically with tears in his eyes. He's going to get up out of that bed and be given the most, advanced weapons, automatic rifles, surface to air, everything. He'll get the training. He'll get the weapons. Now, he doesn't know anything about politics. He doesn't probably never heard of Israel and Palestine. He doesn't know about the treaty problems over Kashmir or anything. It's just for him a question of redeeming his family honor, and he's willing to die for it.
I would think for the kind of research that you do, going out into some rather forbidding places and hanging out with some people who've done some horrific things would be dangerous. Have you ever felt in danger?
Yes. I mean, normally I feel quite welcomed among militants. For one thing, I respect religion in general terms, and they notice this. I respect their culture. For example, with Muslims, I always keep my head covered with the traditional head covering, the hijab, and I respect the local norms and customs. I have always been treated with great respect as a professor, as a woman, as someone interested in learning about the struggle. I've never felt scared in that kind of a way among militants. But I have had a few moments that were quite intense, such as one time after the Gulf War, I was with a group at a camp, and suddenly one of them just turned to me and pointed his AK-47 straight at me. In fact, nudged me in the chest with the end of it, and he suddenly shouted, you know, "We love Saddam Hussein, USA, no." Out of the blue, basically. Hmm. And I just kind of stood there in shock, and other people were around us, also heavily armed, and everyone just stood there for about a minute waiting to see what would happen. And eventually, I did diffuse the situation, really, by responding not defensively but with utter calm and saying to the person, you know, "I'm also critical of some of the things that happened in the Gulf War, and why don't we sit down and talk about it?" And he just stood there and looked at me, and I looked at him, and everyone waited. But eventually he put the gun down, and in fact, we did sit down and talk. And after the talk, we prayed, and we did the Muslim prayer, and they saw that I was wearing a cross at that time around my neck, and they touched the cross. And I took this to mean, whether rightly or wrongly, but I took this gesture to mean now we had prayed their way, and perhaps they wanted to defer and pray in my way. Anyway, I kneeled down, and I showed our prayer gesture, and they immediately kneeled down with me.
My sense is that there are not that many Western scholars who do this kind of field work, especially talking with militants out there.
Not really. There aren't too many. We've tended to study these things from a distance, and my own field of anthropology is one where we believe in hands-on research. But, you know, particularly in the field of terrorism studies, there's been a taboo on actually knowing the subjects of our study.
And really? So the people who we tend to see on TV who are labeled terrorism experts, they haven't actually talked to terrorists?
Most have not. It would be a rarity to find a counterterrorism expert who actually has known terrorists face-to-face. Certainly, prominent figures in the field of terrorism studies have said publicly that the call to understanding terrorists is tantamount to condoning terrorism. And I think I'm appalled to hear that, really, because what other academic field can you think of where the leaders in the field say that purposeful ignorance of the subject is a good thing?
Cynthia Mahmood is an anthropologist at the University of Notre Dame. She talked with Steve Paulson. There's a deep irony in the war against Osama bin Laden and his brand of Islamic militancy. Islam is one of the fastest-growing religions in the United States. In fact, there are now roughly the same number of Muslims living in America as Jews. One convert to Islam is Michael Wolfe, an American who's made the pilgrimage to Mecca. He believed, at least before September 11th, that Islam was poised to become the next great American religion. He says it's a good fit with basic American values, even though religion and politics are closely linked in the Islamic tradition.
I don't think that there is a conflict between separation of church and state. The problem has been frequently that Islam has been hijacked by rulers. You'll remember, for instance, all those really disgusting pictures of Saddam Hussein during the Gulf War praying with a pistol on his hip. I mean, this is absurd. And, of course, it's equally absurd that the American media fell for it, because this is exactly what he wanted. He wanted to show that he was the leader of the faith.
I'm guessing you'd also say that Taliban distorts Islamic teachings?
Yes, exactly. And, you know, when the Taliban explains the multi-billion-dollar opium trade in Afghanistan, then I'll start to listen to them about Islam.
In recent years, Islam has been one of the fastest-growing religions in the United States. Why has it been so appealing to Americans?
This is a religion that stresses individuality, that stresses one's independent relationship to an ethical life and to God. It's a religion that really says, essentially, that it's up to you to develop your own spiritual future. This is a point of view which dovetails pretty nicely with the general attitudes of most Americans. You know, over 50% of America's 6 million Muslims were born here. This is not solely a religion based on immigration. And with statistics like those, that would seem to indicate some sort of a basic agreement between core American values and the beliefs that Muslims hold.
So many Americans' spirituality is rooted in Judaism and Christianity. What makes Islam distinctive from those beliefs?
Well, it gives one a practice. And the practice involves prayer or meditation 5 times a day, which takes a minute or two. It's just checking out of the mainstream flow for a few minutes here and there during your day, which can be very elevating and also kind of a protective experience in the environment that we live in. There's also a month in which Muslims are asked to fast from morning till evening. And once again, in a consumer society such as ours, where so much is based on hunger and on desire and on what one perceives to be one's needs, it's a valuable experience to undertake cessation of some of this intake just for a little while.
Is this really the difference, though? Islam is based, as I understand it, pretty much in the same, it has its roots in the same areas as Judaism and Christianity. In fact, they were around when Islam began and share many of the same beliefs and values. Where does Islam change? Is it simply in these practices?
Islam is like the third side of a triptych, of a spiritual triple painting. It relates directly in its prophetic tradition to the prophets of Judaism and of Christianity. All of those traditions look back to Abraham, the founder, if you will, of ethical monotheism, Moses, the lawgiver. Jesus is an enormously important figure in Islam. His name is never mentioned by a Muslim without following it with peace and blessings be upon him. There are also distinct differences. Islam is not a religion that encourages monasticism or that sees a separation between the mind, the body, and the spirit, or between religion and the community, for that matter, and politics. So there are differences, but you're right, there's a very strong underlying connection. I think of the image that has often been used of wells, deep wells, that all go down to the same source.
I understand that you came to Islam as an adult, is that right?
That's correct.
How were you raised?
My father was Jewish, a little fallen away, but came back in his later life. My mother was Christian, also fallen away. I was raised in a very small town in Ohio, in a very spiritually permissive setup. I went to school with primarily Catholic, Episcopalian, and Protestant kids. A few of us were Jewish. I was confirmed, you might say, they call it that, in the Reform faith. But by the time I was 18 or 19, really neither of these faiths was operative in my life.
Can I ask you what drew you then to Islam?
After college, I finished university in 1968. I'm a writer. I've been a writer for a long time. I was a writer then. I had a scholarship, you might say, to travel and write. And I took that little bit of money and went to Africa. And I lived for about 3.5 years in predominantly Muslim communities, society, traveling through, settling down, living places, working. And I really liked it. I liked the way strangers were treated, myself being a stranger. There was great hospitality in this faith. Hospitality is a measure of quite a lot, in my estimation. And I was always treated with terrific gentleness and a kind of respect. This stuck with me. I didn't become a Muslim then. I didn't become a Muslim for another 20 years. But it was a very positive experience. I should say in my 40s, I became interested in adding a kind of a spiritual element to my life. As a writer, my cynicism was very well honed, or my skepticism at least. I took up the prayer first because it is somewhat like a very simplified yoga and has a little liturgy that goes along with it. And I enjoyed the movements and the exercise of it. And as I say, I enjoyed the ducking out of mainstream time for a few minutes, 4 or 5 times a day. It felt good to me. I liked the idea of it, and I liked the way I felt from it.
You've written about your first pilgrimage to Mecca, the Hajj. Was it different from what you expected?
Oh, yes. I read a few books, and I talked to a few people, but it wasn't really possible to get one's mind around the experience of 2 million people being in, 2 million extra people being in one town all at the same time, all the men wearing white robes, really a set of very large towels is what they're wearing, the women all dressed in very similar, simple clothes. I wasn't ready for the retreat aspect of it. I think in Christian terms, you know, you might think of the Hajj as a huge retreat in which people return to a land that gave birth to Islam. You know, it's also a great kind of a celebration, and it's very interesting emotionally because there are many different stages to it. It morphs into, it starts as a kind of set of urban rites, but before very long, you find yourself in a tent in a desert. Everyone gives up their walls and their air conditioning and their sense of security in a certain way. Goes out and lives in the desert for 2 or 3 days with 2 million strangers. But they're not strangers. They're people who are doing exactly the same. They're there for the same reasons you are. And a lot of camaraderie develops. Very interesting meetings. It's a kind of free-form UN there for 4 or 5 days. Everybody wants to meet everyone, and you do. It's a bit like traveling without a passport. You know, you can cover the world on the Hajj. There are people there from 125 countries, and they're all just dying to meet you. So it's very interesting that way. There are some rites, but there's a lot of time in between them. And you travel in a kind of a circular route, well, a looping route, out into the desert to a distant point about 15 miles outside town. And it takes 3 or 4 days to make this journey. It's a real pilgrimage. And it's been going on for such a long time, for so many centuries, that people have a feeling of participating in something timeless. Now, that's something I never had projected either. I really felt involved in something very timeless, as though these rites were water, you know. We were all vessels, and the water was being poured into us. A very interesting experience. Never had anything like it. I'm sure most people who've gone on Hajj have never had anything like it.
Michael Wolff's books include The Hajj, An American's Pilgrimage to Mecca. He's now working on a TV documentary on the Prophet Muhammad. Would you have the guts to attack armed men on a hijacked plane? Coming up, Profiles in Courage. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Like a lot of people, I marveled at the bravery of the New York firefighters who rushed into the burning World Trade Center while office workers poured out. There's something deeply mysterious about courage, how some people manage to rise above their fears in the most perilous situations. Of course, plenty of leaders throughout history have asked us to be brave.
Let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
We have surmounted all the perils and endured all the agonies of the past. We shall provide against and thus prevail over the dangers and problems of the future.
I can truthfully say to you all that we children at home are full of cheerfulness and courage.
Those World War II calls to courage from Franklin Roosevelt and Winston Churchill to the young Princess Elizabeth played out in popular culture as well. Take Mrs. Miniver, one of the most popular movies during the war.
The homes of many of us have been destroyed, and the lives of young and old have been taken. There's scarcely a household that hasn't been struck to the heart. And why? Surely you must have asked yourselves this question. Why, in all conscience, should these be the ones to suffer? I shall tell you why. Because this is not only a war of soldiers in uniform. It is a war of the people, of all the people. And it must be fought not only on the battlefield, but in the cities and in the villages, in the home and in the heart of every man, woman, and child who loves freedom.
Now, you don't only see courage in war, and it's not always a matter of life and death.
Courage. What makes a king out of a slave? Courage. What makes the flag on the mast to wave? Courage. What makes the elephant charge his tusk in the misty mist or the dusky dusk? What makes the muskrat guard his musk? Courage. What makes the Sphinx the seventh wonder? Courage. What makes the dawn come up like thunder? Courage. What makes the Hottentot so hot? What puts the ape in apricot? What have they got that I ain't got?
Courage.
You could say that again.
Bravely bold Sir Robin brought forth from Camelot. He was not afraid to die. Oh, brave Sir Robin. He was not at all afraid to be killed in nasty ways. Brave, 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 brave Sir Robin. He was not in the least bit scared to be mashed into a pulp, or to have his eyes gouged out and his elbows broken, to have his kneecap split and his body burned away, and his limbs all hacked and mangled, brave Sir Robin. His head smashed in and his heart cut out and his liver removed and his bowels unplugged and his nostrils raped and his bottom burnt off.
And his Monty Python's idea of courage may go a little bit too far. But Steve Paulson wanted a deeper understanding of this most celebrated of virtues. And so he turned to cultural historian William Miller, author of The Mystery of Courage. Miller says the passengers who fought the hijackers on the plane over Pennsylvania were true heroes.
Many of us lie awake fantasizing, what would you do under those kind of circumstances? And in my most self-aggrandizing fantasy, I know I wouldn't, even though I know that plane was going to crash, that I was going to die, I couldn't have ever see myself, even in my fantasies, as being the one who led the attack on the hijackers.
Who were obviously carrying knives, who had probably already killed people on the plane.
I wouldn't be able to do it. But I think, I said this in my fantasies to myself, that I would be able to follow some guy who did take the lead. I wouldn't leave him in the lurch. I could never live with myself if I left somebody who did have the guts to attack. I feel I could follow him, but I wouldn't be able to, I would never have that strength of character to initiate the first rush. So some guy up there did that, and then people followed him. I mean, the country owes them a debt that they can never pay.
Now, cowardice has also been a controversial topic in the last month. Various people, from Bill Maher to Susan Sontag, have objected to the standard descriptions of the hijackers as cowardly, since they were willing to die for what they believed in. And I don't know that we need to rehash that whole controversy, but it's right. Obviously hard to talk about the bravery of our enemies.
Right. Well, that gets kind of complicated. If it was too easy for these guys to suicide, if they believe literally 100% certain, no discount at all, that they are going to go to Islamic heaven for what they did, and they're looking forward to death, they're welcoming it with that kind of, well, then they're just being rational within their system. They're hardly being courageous. And I think there's a way to make it a justifiable, coherent distinction between courage, which often looks pretty like crazy behavior, and fanaticism, which we would not want to glorify or honor at all. You would want to know how easy it is to recruit suicide bombers in their culture. And if it's real easy, then it doesn't take much virtue to do it, because virtue is hard.
You just used the words courage and virtue almost interchangeably, are they?
Yes, I did. And the actual linguistics of it is the word virtue and its earlier meaning simply meant courage and then later was generalized to all of what we call the virtues. But the prime virtue was that virtue which you needed to secure all the other virtues, courage.
Well, maybe if when we're talking about our enemies, maybe it's a little easier if we put it in some historical context, and it's not so immediate, it's not quite so emotional. What about the Japanese in World War II, who were certainly fierce warriors?
They were pretty awesome. It's a complicated issue. We kind of wanted to demonize the Japanese and didn't want to see them as kind of a fully human enemy. Yet for that very reason, they inspired immense terror among, you know, the Western troops who had to face them, who knew they were facing a very seriously dedicated enemy. In the Japanese culture, you could actually declare it to be somebody's duty to be what in the West we would call going beyond the call of duty. And since, again, they got nearly 100% compliance with the norm of death before dishonor, then you could have to say within the Japanese system, they are not being courageous amongst each other. They're just doing their job in a kind of like, they're just conforming. But to the outside world, one Japanese soldier can look at another and say, I'm willing to die. You willing to die? And they can both say, yeah, I'm willing to die. And they say, well, we're just like everybody else here. Big deal. But they can look at each other and say, but you know, the guys on the other side can't say the same thing. So we're some pretty tough mothers.
But aren't there some similarities to the U.S. military? I mean, the whole effort to, in a sense, break down the individual will so that you're following what your commander tells you to do?
Oh, yeah. You know, courage isn't easy. And we use all kinds of techniques to hopefully have our courage last a little longer than some of our natural propensities to run and save our lives. So all the kinds of techniques of military training are an admission, at least in the West, that courage is hard. It's rare, it's difficult, and you want to use all the techniques at your disposal to get it. Shaming, training so that you'll just behave automatically, rah-rahing, rum rations, you know, you give them a shot of whiskey before they got to go charge. You use all these kind of means to hopefully get people to respond to a very difficult call. I'm not about to demean any of those methods. It's hard to do. And the military recognizes it's hard for people to carry out some of the orders they'll be asked to do.
Is courage in battle the highest form of courage? Does it trump all other forms of courage?
Well, you know, let's put it this way. As an historical matter, courage is a martial virtue before it's any other thing. Then it expands conceptually off the battlefield. It's about protecting your loved ones and yourself from hostile attack. And that means hostile physical attack. And I think like we now in a largely pacified culture try and downplay the virtue of pure physical courage. But I would think that moral courage, it doesn't mean anything if it doesn't have a very powerful physical component to it.
If you're not willing to really risk your body, maybe your life, then that's...
Then it's not courage. It's not courage. So let's say you've got this stand up in the meeting willing to defend an unpopular cause against hostile community reaction, that you're kind of the person who says what's on his mind and isn't a little weenie about speaking their mind. And you stand up in a meeting and you say, I take this position, and it's the most unpopular position, and you're going to lose your job. And somebody says, sit down or I'll kick the crap out of you. And you say, oh, I'm sorry, I'll sit down. And that's not moral courage. It's not courage. It's cowardice. You're just mouthing words unless you're going to adhere to the position under certain kinds of threats where your body's on the line.
As you were doing this research and came across examples of moral courage, any particular ones that stood out to you?
Well, yes. And you know where they occur? They occur on the battlefield or in military contexts. So this will make me unpopular again by saying it, but it's there that the situations are so stark and the domain of courage. There was an Israeli lieutenant colonel or a brigade commander who was the youngest brigade commander in the history of the Israeli army at 29. His career path was to be, he would be the commander-in-chief of the armies at the youngest age. He was a star, a superstar. And he was ordered to invade Beirut in 1982, and he refused his orders. He said, I lack the courage to face the parents of my men to explain to them why their kid died. So he blamed himself for lacking the courage to face the parents, lacking moral courage, for taking a morally courageous stand of destroying his own career. His career was destroyed. And it turned out that there was no invasion of Beirut. So, I mean, it wasn't even that his refusal of orders wasn't just a kind of a symbolic statement. I mean, it altered the policy.
That must have been awfully hard for him to go home then.
Well, imagine his situation. He goes home and he's cheered by the doves, people for whom he has utter contempt. It's like being welcomed by the peaceniks. It was for him the punishment for what he did. And what he did immediately to show his commanders that he wasn't refusing orders because he was afraid to die, he immediately re-enlisted in the ranks as a private to said, I'll go face bullets. That isn't the issue.
You know, one thing that strikes me in this whole conversation is that, at least the way we've talked about courage, it's so closely tied to our notions of manliness. And
yes,
traditionally, calling a man a coward is sort of like calling him a sissy. And certainly for any man in the military, the last thing you want to be called is anything that would make you look like a woman. I mean, it's not very nice to say, but that's just the way
the language of courage in every language, actually English does it less than most, but the word for courage is almost always the same, the word for man. Vir, virtue, is virile. Virtue is the Latin word for man. In languages, it is clear that the virtue has been gendered historically. But, you know, there's a lot of anxiety behind that.
Well, it's absurd to think that women are never courageous.
Oh, well, men know that. Let me put it this way. One of the things that gets played out in the cultural history of the idea of courage is whether courage is best manifested on offense or best manifested on defense. Offense has always said, well, it just takes, it's very male. It's like quick spurts of energy and then exhaustion. Defense means you just have to be there day in, day out, taking crap. And defense starts to get feminized so that it's not just men who play defense, but it's women who play defense. And it turns out women can take more crap than men. So that defense, the whole courage of defense gets expanded, gets off the battlefield, gets away from men and becomes Christian patience, sufferance, fortitude, at which women are historically as good or better than men at. But also, if you think about it this way, there's another kind of interesting thing, is that who raises these little boys? Who raises the men in these cultures? You think some man is standing over a woman cooing to her little child? No. That's totally delegated. The reproduction of the honor culture is left to women to reproduce.
Although it might be left to the peers when the boy goes to school and there are certain
expectations. It's a lot left to the peers. But in heroic cultures, it's the women who say, you want to get in my bed again? You ever want to set foot in this bed again? Then go kill Thord. Or mothers saying to their kids, there's one famous example of a Gothic matron who sees her son running in battle from some Roman cohort or something, and she lifts up her skirts and shows her genitals to her son and says, crawl back in, you coward.
Wow.
These are tough ladies, you know.
William Miller, talking with Steve Paulson. Miller's the author of The Mystery of Courage. Coming up, how should we commemorate those who died on September 11th? Turn New York's Ground Zero into a memorial? Or build another World Trade Center? I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Before September 11th, the bombing of the Murrah Building in Oklahoma City was the worst terrorist attack in American history. Cultural historian Ed Linenthal spent 5 years studying the emotional fallout from that tragedy, and now he's written a book called the unfinished bombing. Linenthal says people deal with such an awful event by telling stories that put the trauma in some perspective. We've seen the same thing in New York City. In the first days after the attacks, we had the heroic narrative, the rescue workers trying to find survivors. We've heard other narratives as well, of religious redemption and civic renewal. But Linenthal told Ann Strainchamps that we're still faced with a toxic narrative.
We need to have some respect for the power of evil that was present here and what it does not only to family members of those killed and wounded, not only to those who are working at the site, but the incredible ripple impact of this throughout thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people. I mean, Oklahoma City, it was breathtaking to see how far out this spread, how many hundreds of thousands of people, for example, had to make decisions on whose funerals they went to, on how children, preschool children who were left home alone to watch recycled images of the Mira building thought it was a new building being blown up each time they saw it, and to this day kick the walls of new buildings before they go into it, on how police departments and EMSA teams and fire departments and the helping professions saw rise in domestic abuse and drug abuse and divorce and suicide rates. This is the toxic narrative. There's also a traumatic narrative that focuses on, for example, how victims of political violence are transformed into patients with an illness, post-traumatic stress syndrome, and how stories that are really often moral testimony or witness stories are transformed into trauma narratives, and how people are perceived as sort of passive victims suffering from an illness.
That's interesting, because that's one of the things you found in Oklahoma City, right? That the family members and victims did not always really welcome the counselors and psychologists who were moving in to try to help. In some cases, they really rejected the interpretations they got.
Yeah, absolutely. One psychologist said to me that people begin to inhabit diagnoses they're given. And many family members and survivors did, in fact, reject this and turn to various forms of active grieving, work for or against the death penalty, habeas corpus reform, work on victims' rights movement, and work on memorialization. Because work on memorialization became, for many people, a way of engaging the event itself.
Well, and there are two kinds of memorialization, right? Because there was also the just spontaneous outpouring that came from millions of people around the country. I mean, people sent letters and, I mean, all kinds of things happened, and that was just a spontaneous welling up.
When I read these thousands of letters and drawings and blueprints and design architects who would write in and say, I'm not religious, but last night I had a vision of what the memorial ought to be, and then blueprints an inch thick, which said to me something about the impact of this event on human consciousness. So there's that whole dimension of this unsolicited memorial vocabulary. There is, as you suggest, this sort of populist memorialization that we know so well from the Vietnam Veterans Memorial that has its roots certainly in Latino and Roman Catholic traditions in the past of memorializing sites of violence with a cross or with flowers. It becomes more complex at the Vietnam Veterans Memorial or at Oklahoma City. You have planned leavings, you have spontaneous leavings, and I've looked at all of this stuff in some detail at the Oklahoma City Memorial Foundation Archive.
What kind of things did people leave?
Well, people left all kinds of material items. They left teddy bears. They left pictures of angels. They left prayer cards. They left business cards. They left earrings. They left shoes. They left pieces of clothing. They left photographs. They left hard hats from some of the people that may have worked there. They left messages, floral arrangements of all kind, T-shirts, sports hats, towels from local hotel rooms, incredible range of material. Lots of What Would Jesus Do? Bracelets, for example, Native American dream catchers, all sorts of things.
What did the city do with all this
well,
stuff?
Well, it is all cataloged and archived in the Oklahoma City Memorial Archive, and it was an incredible thing to go through because it's a window into the culture and the sensibilities of the culture in a very interesting way.
Is the same kind of thing happening in New York City now, do you know? This kind of spontaneous, you know,
yes,
welling up of artifacts?
It is. And I have not been, but a number of friends have told me that they're in front of fire departments and police departments and certainly near the site that there's an incredible array and archive of spontaneous memorialization that I believe now is going to be kept and cataloged as well.
Another parallel, I wonder if you would think of this as a form of memorialization. In the case of Oklahoma City, there was a photograph that emerged as a kind of icon. We've all seen it, the photograph of the firefighter holding the baby in his arms.
Yes, the fireman and the baby, one of the most powerful American icons of our time that really takes its place with the famous shot of the USS Arizona Memorial and JFK's assassination photographs and Kim Phuc in Vietnam running down the street, the naked girl who had just been napalmed, Chris Fields holding 1-year-old Bailey Ammon, her first birthday was the day before the bombing, in his arms before he hands her to an ambulance worker to take her away. That photograph, of course, becomes a natural idea for a memorial, and there are hundreds and hundreds of suggestions of this for a memorial. Statues were sent to the city, including an 11-foot, 2-ton cast-iron black statue of the fireman and the baby standing on a prone terrorist holding a hand grenade or some kind of explosive ready to throw it. This was going to go up in Oklahoma City with other statues, and Erin Ammon Koch, Bailey's mother, had to go to the mayor and I believe the governor saying that this is not how she wanted her child remembered.
I can't help but think how incredibly difficult for the real mother, for the other victims and families of victims, because what you're describing is a mourning process that got, in some ways, just out of control and couldn't be controlled or didn't revolve anymore around the people who were the most hurt.
Very difficult, although for some family members, there was solace to be taken in the kind of public eulogies that access to the media allowed them to do. But for Erin, for example, she told me, and I'll never forget one of our conversations, she was gracious beyond words to talk with me a number of times about these very painful and intimate things. When she went to buy funeral clothes for Bailey, a couple asked if they could have their picture taken with her. She said that she didn't feel comfortable going out in public for a long time because if she smiled, someone might think that she didn't love Bailey enough, didn't work actively on memorial projects because if she perhaps gave her opinion about something and it worked out that way, people might say, well, she just got her way because of Bailey. Some of the other mothers who had children killed grew resentful at the attention that Bailey got. So it was tremendously difficult for everyone. But that kind of spotlight, she handled it with a tremendous grace and courage that I'm simply awestruck by.
Well, one of the things that you write about that was so fascinating and so important for people in Oklahoma City was the family members really were able to take control, partly, of this whole process through the memorialization process, through deciding what kind of memorial there would be and how it would look and when it would go up and where it would go. That was really important.
It was incredibly important. And against all conventional wisdom by professionals who run design competitions, that while you can listen to family members, clearly their torment, their trauma, their grief is simply too much to allow them to be part, an essential part of the process, that they'll sort of muck it up and you need this cold, detached view. The mission statement of the memorial task force made it very clear that their voice was to be dominant.
What sorts of issues and debates did this group have to deal with?
They were very difficult issues to think about. For example, there was a street in front of the Mirror Building called Fifth Street, and it was closed temporarily. The plan was for it to open it again, but when memorial plans begin to arise, it was seen that they wanted a seamless memorial that stretched from the Mirror Building across Fifth Street to include the Journal Record Building, which had been badly damaged and now houses the Memorial Center Museum and store. Well, this was a real issue about closing Fifth Street. Different philosophical convictions about memorialization. Open the street. We don't want terrorists to alter our city landscape. Close the street. This is where people died in the street. They were carried out in the street. So eventually it was closed. Another issue that was tremendously difficult, it was decided in the mission statement that alongside some representation of the 168 who died, which is, of course, now in this tremendously moving exhibit of 168 empty lighted chairs with names on it, the names of survivors would be located somewhere on the site. Well, if you're going to put survivors' names up, who's a survivor? So the whole issue was tremendously volatile. And it's not an unusual one. People often sort of roll their eyes when I mention this issue. But if we believe that there's a difference between someone who came out of the Mirror Building who was badly injured, who lost not only his place, his or her place of work, but a community where they knew so many people, mm-hmm. where they perhaps were in the hospital, where then they had to decide who of the 10 funerals of my friends do I go to on 12 successive days, if there's a difference between that experience and someone driving by on I-40 who said, I saw it, I was terribly upset, I'm kind of a survivor too. I mean, if we want to draw a line between those experiences, now you're into memorial hierarchy. And the issue of memorial hierarchy is always important.
You know, I just can't help but think, listening to you, of course we're thinking about New York City.
Absolutely.
I mean, we're talking about 100-some people in Oklahoma and 6,000 in New York City. How on earth will this process ever play out?
I don't know. And the scale of New York makes the participatory model difficult. Not impossible, perhaps, but difficult. New York is not Oklahoma City either. And we see there the philosophical poles have already been established. We must rebuild as an act of protest and as an act of defiance, as an act of getting back to business as usual. I heard someone say, interviewed about this, New York is a city of skyscrapers. We're not like Oklahoma City. Were I to make the case for the other pole, that this is land that has been transformed by the death of so many and that rebuilding and going back to business as usual is a kind of act of defilement, the first sentence, if I wanted to make this case, would be an unprecedented act of domestic terrorism calls for an unprecedented use of the most valuable real estate in New York City. I mean, that would be the first sentence for that argument.
Ed Lindenthal is a cultural historian at the University of Wisconsin-Oshkosh. He talked with N. Strainchamps about his book, The Unfinished Bombing, Oklahoma City in American Memory.
I will remember you. Will you remember me? Don't let your life pass you.
It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can buy a tape of this show by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for Terror and the Aftermath, program number 1021A. If you'd like to comment on what you've heard, write to us at To the Best of Our Knowledge, 821 University Avenue, Madison, Wisconsin, 53706. Or send us email through our website at www.wpr.org/book.
PRI, Public Radio International.
We've got a million expressions for death: kicking the bucket, chucking out, buying the farm. But what do we do when words aren't enough? Next week on To the Best of Our Knowledge, artisans are finding new passages through grief, from graffiti memorials to handcrafted coffins. Also, the master of the macabre, Edgar Allan Poe. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.